Welcome, everybody, to an afternoon session here. We're thrilled to have you with us. We have a very exciting panel. We are going to be trying to get the volume good here. We are going to be talking today about the advanced track of climate action planning. And I think it's a really interesting point to think about what is the advanced track of climate action planning. I know frequently when I reach out to local governments that I would give this label to, they tell me, no, we're not there. So I think that we all have different definitions of what the advanced track is. And I think what we're going to talk about today is a couple of local governments' very specific experience over time. And I think that most local governments that have been doing this for some time, even though they still have many lessons to learn, are on the advanced track. So lots of local governments have been doing this even since the 90s and before. And some have just started, but have started on a fast track. So there's different degrees. I'm going to open up today's session and then turn it over for the bulk of the time to our two speakers. My name is Monica Gilchrist. I am the Interim California Director for ICLEI, Local Governments for Sustainability. I'm going to talk briefly, I'm going to set the stage about sustainability, milestones for progressing through sustainability, give a little high-level overview of where folks are in the nation, and talk about some resources available through the Statewide Energy Efficiency Collaborative. Then we have two really dynamite speakers lined up. We have James Caruso. He's a senior planner with San Luis Obispo County and has a very interesting and diverse background. He has worked in everything from nuclear waste storage, oil field remediation, resource damage assessments, and he's currently jumping from those things into the climate change and energy piece and is helping to prepare the EnergyWise plan, which is San Luis's version of the climate action plan. He's going to get into some detail about their experiences with that I think are going to be very exciting. And then Garrett Fitzgerald, who many of you already know, is with the City of Oakland. He's the sustainability coordinator, leading lots of collaborative approaches, and in particular, he's developed Oakland's draft energy and climate action plan and the 2010 Sustainable Oakland Report, and I think he has some of those things with him today to share with you as well. All right. So ICLEI is a nonprofit organization. We are a membership organization made up of local governments. We have close to 600 local governments in the U.S. that have joined ICLEI to further their sustainability goals. We provide resources, tools, and services that help drive a deep reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. We work through local governments because that's where change is made. All of you folks on the ground are changing it. You're addressing climate change, and it's really where the rubber meets the road, and it's the best way that these types of sustainability initiatives can really get implemented. A lot of current sustainability is really driven by policy, particularly here in California. So a lot of the conversation around climate action planning really relates back to policy. So when we talk about greenhouse gas emissions inventories, climate action plans, how they relate to policy in California is a very important piece of the equation. And some of the high points of where that relationship is the most essential is in the AB 32 scoping plan, CEQA, and the state has a really comprehensive and pretty incredible adaptation plan. For anyone who hasn't seen it, it's definitely worth looking at. In ICLEI, over the past several years, we've developed the 5 milestones for climate mitigation. We have an equal set of milestones for the adaptation process as well. These ones, and they read pretty much the same for adaptation as for mitigation, where you start with the emissions inventory. In adaptation, you start with your risk assessment, looking across the board. So the first milestone in mitigation is doing an inventory of your emissions. And I think this is a lot of what local governments have done to date. many local governments in California have either done or are preparing to do an inventory. And the inventory is either of their local government operations or at the community scale, or for many, both. And my next slide is going to show you where local governments are across the nation in terms of their milestones. And this is the one that has the most folks have done this, number one, the most. Number two is establishing a target. So once you have your inventory, what are you going to do with it? Where do you want to move to? So you know what you where you emit. The target is where you want to be. Three is your plan to get there, to get from milestone one to milestone two. It's your measures. And then number four is where it gets tough, going out there and doing it, actually implementing. And five is looking at it, monitoring, evaluating, and going back. But that piece in the middle, the leadership commitment, you all know very well, that's the key piece. Oops. There we go. This is what's interesting. What's going on across the nation, and this is specifically about ICLEI members. So there are probably local governments outside of this that are not counted in here. But looking in ICLEI's membership, in our annual report, we determined that 355 of our members have done milestone one. So that's an inventory. 204, and this is of about close to a current number of about 600. Milestone two, about 200, a little over 200 have done that. That's set a target. Milestone three, that's the climate action plan, about 162. Milestone, and you see these numbers drop tremendously as we get into now this would be the advanced track. So milestone four is implementing. So that's going out and doing what you've said you were going to do in your climate action plan, only about 40. And having done that part, going back and monitoring and starting over again, changing it up, only about 25 local governments. And this is nationwide. So this is clear that a lot of us are at the front end of this. Not very many have reached the tail end of that. And so a lot of what is going on in this community now is the resources to get those milestones four and five. They're the most important. That's where this work gets done. So one place where there are a number of resources available is the Statewide Energy Efficiency Collaborative, of which you've all heard a lot today, yesterday. It is a collaborative funded by the investor-owned utilities, PG&E, SDG&E, Southern California Edison, and the Gas Company, and implemented by the Institute for Local Governments, who's doing the Beacon Awards. The Local Government Commission, who is hosting this event today, as well as many other meetings and webinars and supportive convening efforts. And then ICLEI is doing trainings and tools and resources around the SEEK program. So these tools and resources are free to all local governments. They can be found online at californiaseek.org, which is this website, californiaseek.org. Among the resources that are available include an inventory tool that is an online inventory tool at the community scale, climate action planning quick guides, templates. The quick start guides give an overview of each milestone. So we have them for one, two, and three. One looks at emissions, two looks at target setting and forecasting, and three looks at climate action planning. We also have data collection tools such as master data workbooks, and these are very exciting tools that help you categorize and easily track your data. The climate action planning template gives you a place to house it all and gives you an incredible start for telling your story. It's a very exciting tool. It has example focus areas and initiatives. And then we're in the process right now of developing California CAPA, which is in the beta testing form right now. And this is a reduction measures tool that takes into account many of the current policy issues in California. So they're embedded in the tool. This tool is out for beta testing right now, and it will be available within the next month or so. And it's a very exciting addition, particularly for those on the advanced track that are looking for new ways to look at measures. So thank you. If you have any questions, we're going to go through the speakers, and then we'll take questions after each speaker, and then we'll have real conversation toward the end. So I'm going to turn it over now to James Caruso from San Luis Obispo.
Okay, thank you, Monica. So a long time ago, in a life far, far away, I was told by someone who was very smart that whenever you're talking to a group, never get stuck behind a podium. Because you can't talk to people when you're behind a podium. You have to be out there in front of them. So I think Garrett and I are going to practice that today. As Monica said, my name is James Caruso. I'm a senior planner with the San Luis Obispo County Planning Department. Really, I feel like an odd man out here. We're a small rural county who somehow has stumbled into what I think is the lead in county's climate action plans. We've stumbled into the lead because we just have this serendipitous moment where we have a board majority who is very much into energy efficiency, water conservation, very progressive agenda, so we're taking advantage of having that political support to work very quickly. A little bit of background on San Luis Obispo County. We're a small county, 270,000 people. The unincorporated jurisdiction is only 108,000. Of that 108,000, we have a rural population of 43,000 people. And the importance of those 43,000 people is in our transportation sector. You live 8 miles east of 101, which is our backbone transportation corridor. You need to get in your car and drive probably 12 miles one way for a pack of smokes and a quart of milk at midnight. It's very much VMT oriented. We have a lot of local vehicle miles traveled. It's one of our banes of our existence in this climate action plan, and it's one of our implementing tools, which I'll talk about in a minute, is trying to change that focus from rural development to urban development. We also have this situation where the coast is the more progressive area. Coastal area actually doesn't have that much of a climate problem or a weather problem. It's cool in the summer, cool in the winter, it's cooler in the summer. However, our interior area, our North County especially, is hot in the summer, cold in the winter. It's where we need to make some efforts to retrofit our older housing stock, for instance. However, that's where we have some of our lesser progressive population living. So a lot of our efforts are going in to try to educate people. And we also know that our 3-2 board majority is not going to last, so we're on a fast track to get this stuff done. And there we are. Just south of Monterey, just north of Santa Barbara, right on the coast. And I'll add, like a lot of people, please come, visit, spend your money, then get out. Don't move there. And if you do move there, don't move to a 5-acre piece of heaven out in the rural area. So what I'd like to talk about a little bit today is some of the lessons that we've learned in getting this climate action plan done. Just FYI, the Climate Action Plan is out on the streets. The first draft has been out for a month, 2 months now. We have gotten lots of comments. I've been told from many people that the number of comments we have gotten on our Climate Action Plan from our stakeholders far outweighs anything anyone has experienced. We have hundreds of comments from people, and they range in spectrum from the Tea Party all the way to the very progressive elements who don't think we're going far enough. I'd like to talk about a little bit about the things we've done right and things we'd like to do over again. Talk a little bit about implementation, which of course is the hardest part of all of this. It's easy to produce a plan. You're discovering that implementing that plan, as tough as the plan was, the implementation part is going to be that much tougher. And we're also going to talk about adaptation. Chapter 8 of our Climate Action Plan, or EnergyWise Plan, as we've rebranded it, is adaptation. Thank you to Kate Meese and Local Government Commission for providing a great deal of information for us on adaptation. We have a long list of stakeholders and people who have been part of the efforts to produce this plan. I'm not going to call out anyone in particular except for what's called the Green Team. By now, I hope every city and county has a Green Team made up of all agency staff, headed up by the CAO's office in our case. Because when you're in the CAO's office, you have a whip hand that you can bring down on all of those recalcitrant department heads who don't want to be a part of your climate work. It's been pretty effective in our county. We're getting very good responses from all of our departments. Here's our pie chart. Garrett has a similar pie chart, I believe, in your presentation. Well, this happens to be our pie chart, the percentage of emissions from each of these sectors. You'll notice down in the bottom left-hand corner, transportation. Transportation tends to always be the highest. That number, when we first did our inventory a couple of years ago, that number was 65%. That number has been reduced to 40% because, and I'll talk about it in a minute, we hired a traffic engineer, Farron Piers, to do a traffic model, and we went from 65 to 40% by subtracting out what's called pass-through traffic, all those hundreds of thousands of, in our case, tens of thousands of cars a day passing down 101 on the way from Monterey to Santa Barbara were taken out of our vehicle miles traveled number, and so that number has gone down. Everything else has gone up. Also want you to look at the upper left-hand corner. Cities, of course, can ignore this. We can't. We're an agricultural county. 18% of our emissions is from agriculture. Everything from flatulent cows to tractors burning diesel fuel to tilling the land and emitting carbon from tillage practices. Well, we're amongst friends here, so I can tell you that they are the toughest sector to deal with. Agriculturalists do not want to be regulated. They don't want to talk to you because if they talk to you, you might be regulating them. So it's taken us about 2 years to get to a point where at least it's a standoff. They don't throw us out of their office. They listen politely, and in some cases, they're willing to participate in the process. This is what I call our scary graph. This really tells you the story of how difficult this is going to be. Business as usual from 2006, and our baseline year is 2006. And I assume everyone, if you're in the advanced track, you know something about this, so I'm not going to go into any detail. Business as usual is taking us up on that slope of that line is rising, of course. One of the more interesting things is the line with the triangles looks a lot like the baseline. That's business as usual, but calculating in the state reductions, the reductions we're going to get from state programs, such as clean fuels, raising the CAFE standards. That's what I found to be scary, is that we were thinking, wow, we've got to get a lot of reduction from what the state's doing, right? Well, the only thing that's going to do is it's going to keep us at baseline. So that means that everything that has to be done to bring us below baseline, 20% by 2020, is going to have to be part of our local efforts. And one of the things we discovered is our local efforts are going to be very difficult through local efforts to get that line to slope downward like that. This is how we broke up the EnergyWise plan. Energy, waste, transportation, agriculture, and the other category. The other category right now mostly consists of our airport operations. Anyone ever flown into San Luis Obispo Airport? It's a bus station, basically. Looks like a bus station. We have about 8 flights a day. It's not a real big deal. It wasn't worth calculating in by itself, and it wasn't worth putting in to other categories, so we kept it as other. I wanted to give an example of some of the reduction strategies that we've developed. Some of them are the typical ones, the Energy Efficiency Financing Program, please. We have listened to our building sector. Our new building construction, we know, is very, very energy efficient. You're not going to reduce your greenhouse gas emissions on the backs of new development. However, you are going to reduce emissions on the backs of old development. Anything that was built prior to the beefing up of Title 24 in 94, one of those times, we know that those buildings need to be retrofitted. So that's one of the targets that one of the things that we're targeting very strongly in our implementation end is try to identify those buildings, those houses that were built before the 1990s in the climate zones that experience those hot summers and cold winters. The one in red on the bottom, I gotta tell you a story about this. So our EnergyWise plan came out a couple of months ago. The same week that our board of supervisors, or actually the same week that the World Health Organization released their cell phone study that says if you use your cell phone, you're gonna get brain cancer. So we have been inundated with people who want to stop the rollout of smart meters. And you know, you can't argue with people who are telling you that they're dying from these electromagnetic fields. You have to stand there and say, yes, we understand. However, we can't take out deployment of smart meters. It's part of the smart grid. And deploying the smart grid is, we're getting tens of thousands of tons of reductions from that. Luckily, our board did adopt a resolution asking the CPUC to stop the rollout, give people an opt-out procedure, et cetera. So the only thing we've really had to do is reduce the number of participants from 100% of smart meters to perhaps 90%. Oh, and before I get in trouble when I get back, I do have to mention that we were able to hire a consultant. We were funded to hire a consultant to help us with this, and that's PMC, in case any of you know that that company. All right, I said my piece for them. Here's another one. I've taken out most of them for the sake of time, but I had to leave this one in. Here's an example of tree planting. It's an example of where you're not going to get reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. You're not even going to be able to quantify your reductions from this. People love tree planting programs. So we've actually expanded this from county-maintained roads, medians, and rights-of-way to everyone is going to be planting trees. And the way we've got into this, anyone heard of the organization called One Cool Earth? Local guy, absolutely fantastic organization. They're going to help us implement this massive tree planting program. Very passionate about what they're doing. They stay on message. It's a wonderful organization. Any of you from the East Coast, perhaps, you might have remembered in the 60s, when I was a kid in New York, Plant a Tree for Israel program was started, 1963, I think. The most successful tree planting program the world has ever seen. They've planted 10 million trees in the desert in the Middle East. That's something that we want to try to emulate in San Luis Obispo County. Here's a truism. If you're going to be asking the private sector to do something, your city or county has got to be willing to set the example. And in fact, that's the way we started this 2 years ago. By assuring people that we're not going to be asking the public or the private sector to do anything that the county is not going to do. And we've put our money literally where our mouth is. We're not a rich county, we're a rural county, we're budget challenged like everyone else. The Board of Supervisors is putting about $100,000 a year for the past several years into energy efficiency in the county buildings. We use the majority of our EECBG money to retrofit county buildings, including the men's and women's jail, high-profile projects. That was over $1 million we put into that. County operations, of course, then becomes pretty important in the reduction strategies. I want to point out one or couple of these things. Brand new LEED certified government center, not quite working well, so people are bringing fans in the summer. They're bringing in their little personal heaters for their feet in the wintertime because their feet are cold. We don't know how to get rid of those. General Services does sweeps through people's offices, unannounced, unplugging these things and taking them and giving them back only when people promise to take them home. The next day they reappear. We're not sure what the answer is to that, but it's vexing everyone. Two other things I want to mention about county operations is you have to enlist your city manager or your CAO's office. They are the ones who have to take the lead. As Monica mentioned, I'm from the planning department. Just like a lot of people in the private sector don't like to see someone from the planning department knocking on their door, other agencies don't like it either because they know it's not going to be good news, and actually it often isn't. However, with the city CAO's office taking the lead, there's no question that agency directors are going to be participating in all of these programs. And then finally, we've found some interesting allies in county operations. The Parks Department. A lot of turnover recently in our Parks Department. We have young people coming in. Our parks planners, our two parks planners, are under 30 years old. They're really into this stuff. We were going to leave them alone because they really never were responsive. They've approached us. Our golf course superintendent's 30 years old. They're looking to go to a zero waste program. So you find your allies where you can find them, and some of them are surprising. The library. Library can't really do anything, but they're really into this program. So we use them as much as we can. How am I doing on time? Oh, I guess I'm doing fine. Let's talk a little bit about things that we perhaps didn't do quite right. Some things we might have done right. We didn't know this, but you have to work on branding. I think we heard from gentlemen that, after lunch about branding your plan, branding your efforts. Part of that means you have to make this thing about this program about several things. You can't just make it about greenhouse gas emissions reductions, because there are a lot of people out there who don't care. Matter of fact, some of them are actively hostile to the idea. You're not going to be able to sell that idea to them. So make it about several things. Make it about energy efficiency. Make it about saving money. Make it about losing weight. Make it about better health. You also bring in all of your other advisory committees, and, like our public health advisory committee. They're strongly behind our plan because we have a walkable community strategy in there, and we have other things that they wanted to put in it. Remember your title. We changed it. It was a climate action plan. It is now Slo County Energy Wise. And it has been effective in changing the name, has been effective in getting new people involved in this. Make sure your format is understandable and interesting. Sloplanning.org, sloplanning.org. Go to the website, find the draft of the plan, and you can see how we put it together in a very modern style. If you put an older magazine next to a newer magazine, for a time I had a subscription to Sports Illustrated and ESPN, the magazine. Sports Illustrated was a normal, everyday, old line magazine. It had a picture here and text over here. I'm older. I like that. I like to read. You look at a new style magazine, you can't tell the difference between content and ads. Everything is a little blurb. Well, unfortunately, I got to stop saying that. Fortunately or unfortunately, that's what we have done. We have minimized the text. We have increased the margins. We've put pictures. We've put quotes in there. We have things that we call it marginalia, a wide margin along one side. And we have quotes from like Teddy Roosevelt. We have pictures of manufacturing of solar panels. We have little bits of factoids about San Luis Obispo and energy efficiency. This way, if you're not a reader, if you're under the age of 40 or 30, and you don't like to read, you at least have something to look at. Well, Monica said we had to be provocative. I'm trying. And then the last thing is, you need to sell this. I was talking to someone in line at lunch, that very long line at lunch, and I said, you know, I'm really sorry I went to school to be a planner, and all of my experience for 25 years is in planning. If I had known I was going to get involved in this, I would have been a marketing major, because this is about marketing. And what does a county or city know about marketing? Not a whole heck of a lot. So my only advice is learn it. Either learn how to do it or hire someone who knows how to do it. That's part of our problem right now, is we're struggling on how to sell this thing, how to market our plan. Luckily, we have a pretty isolated market in San Luis Obispo. Talking just lately about how to get the news media more involved in what we're doing. So this is what we came up with. Slo County Energy Wise, designing energy and climate solutions for the future. That would have cost us about $50,000 if we had gone to a consultant to create a new moniker for us. We came up with that in about a half an hour in our boss's office of writing things down on the whiteboard. Pretty good? It's pretty good. You're allowed to steal it if you want. Just give us credit. So this is one of the things that we're trying to market this plan as, and we call them co-benefits, and we have 10 of them. It not only reduces greenhouse gas emissions, which you might not care about, but it also conserves energy, it promotes equity, it improves health, it improves air quality, provides educational opportunities, it reduces water use, it saves you money. That seems to be the real selling point. Improves mobility. We constantly are emphasizing these points when we go out and do our outreach. which, by the way, if you do go into this business of developing a climate action plan, you will spend most of your time on the road. You need to talk to people, and there's the only way to sell this, to lay the groundwork, is to talk to people and create a personal contact with people, face-to-face contact, not necessarily in large groups like this. I sometimes joke that if there's two people standing on the sidewalk, you have to go up to them and talk about climate action plan, about the EnergyWise plan. You got to get them excited about what's going on. So here are some of the pitfalls, and there's a lot of them. First of all is adequate staffing. I'm very lucky in that I was able, we had the funding to hire a consultant, PMC. I don't know how I would do it. I would have done this without a consultant. Matter of fact, we couldn't have done it without a consultant. Heather, raise your hand. Heather's from Santa Barbara County. We can all feel sorry for Heather. She's trying to do it, they're trying to do it on the cheap, on her back. I'm sorry, Heather, but you're not going to be able to do it, as you know. You need to talk management into getting you some consultant assistance. It's just not going to happen. When you go out to the building industry, just don't talk to your home builders association. We had the most fun I've ever had in my career was at a stakeholders meeting where we put our traditional builders in the same room as the folks who build straw buildings, who are green builders. And they went at it for about an hour and a half, talking past each other. The traditional builders say, well, I can't do what you do. I'm building production homes. I'm building 100 at a time. And the green builders were saying, well, yes, you can. You can do this and this and this. Well, no, we can. It's not cost effective. At the end of the 2 hours, they started talking to each other. Matter of fact, they meet regularly now, and they teach each other how to do these things. It was one of our early successes, and simply keeping those guys from killing each other, I think, was a success. Ag, if you're a county and you have agriculture, I've already talked about agriculture. One of the best things we did, though, is we enlisted some of the key agriculturalists who do believe in this to go out and spread their own message. Because remember, agriculturalists, they're not going to listen to someone from the government. We're not their friends, according to them. However, if they have another agriculturalist out there talking to them, they'll listen to that message. No matter how early you start, start even earlier. There's no early start to this. This stuff takes time, and it takes patience, and it takes focus, and it takes discipline. Which is funny, because I have no patience, no focus, and no discipline, so I'm not sure how we've been so successful. Once again, take the show on the road. Anybody who will listen to you, talk to them. Talk to them face to face. Don't get stuck behind the podium. Sit down with them and explain some of the things that are in the plan. Propane. You know, no one regulates propane. We're a rural county. We got 43,000 people in the rural area who don't know natural gas from a hole in the wall. The propane dealer comes out and fills their tank whenever they need it. We have no idea how much propane is used. So we went to the propane dealers. We said, you know, we're doing this plan. We need to know how much propane we use. The stock answer is, we're not regulated. We don't want to be regulated. We're a clean fuel. Now get out of the office. That hasn't changed. We don't expect it to change. This is one of those holes in our inventory that there's just no filling. One thing I will say about the inventory, you measure what you can measure. You don't measure what you can't measure. Propane is not measurable. I don't know what else to say. You can't include propane in your inventory. You can't include it in your reduction strategies. Real quick, adaptation. One of the things we've learned about adaptation is it's a very slow process. It has to be a well thought out process. You don't immediately go in and rip out your infrastructure along the coast. However, you don't build new infrastructure along your coast either. If you need to rebuild your treatment plant that happens to be at an elevation of 4 feet above sea level, don't think about replacing your treatment plant on the present site. Move it inland. If this is what your plan is to rebuild that treatment plant. Roads. Instead of rebuilding a road that follows the coast that's been wiped out year after year in the storms, start thinking now about moving it out. Adaptation is going to be a tough one for us. Luckily, though, we have, difference between adaptation and mitigation. Mitigation are the policies that reduce greenhouse gas emissions and enhance sinks. That's pretty simple. However, adaptation is what you do because you know that by reducing greenhouse gas emissions, you're still going to come up with problems in the future. We have some very passionate people in the county who have been supporters of this EnergyWise plan until we started talking about adaptation. To them, adaptation is giving up, and they don't want us to give up. Their assumption is, well, if we're talking about adapting to climate change, we're not going to try as hard to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We don't agree with that. However, it's a very valid statement, and it's something that you have to be ready to answer, which we're doing with varied success. We have a local hazard mitigation plan that we're working on right now. Part of that's the vulnerability assessment. What type of, how are we vulnerable? What's your water supply like? What's your agricultural resources going to happen? How's your fire hazard going to be affected? How are you going to protect against sea level rise? Your local hazard mitigation plan is the key to adaptation. And now finally, implementation. We have so many unquantified reduction strategies because they're things that were pushed by the community or people really wanted to see them. Those actually become easy to implement because you have people who are already passionate about it. You might not be able to measure it, but at least you can implement it. We have progress indicators. For our land use section, remember those 43,000 people in the rural area. Well, all those people live there because we've issued a certain number of building permits every year in the rural area, certain number of building permits in the urban area. We've been tracking that for a good dozen years or so. So we know that our progress indicators in our land use section are going to be from here until for the next 10 years. We want to reduce that percentage of rural building permits and increase the percentage of urban building permits. Right now, it's about a 60-40 split, urban-rural. We would like to bring that up to 70-30 in the next 10 years. Unfortunately, that's another difficult thing. People don't generally move to San Luis Obispo County to live in a condo in Atascadero. They tend to move here to live on the 5-acre horse ranch. It's our job to tell them, oh, sorry about that, but we think that urban lifestyle is going to be more suitable. County and community costs, you need to track costs. You need to track costs not only to the public sector, but to the community. We had a question here in the last Climate Action Plan section about return on investment and how much this stuff costs. You need to keep a close eye on that because a lot of people are interested. A lot of people are interested in how much bang for the buck you're getting. It's one of the things that we're struggling with now. When we finally publish the final EnergyWise plan, we're going to have to beef up our cost-benefit, sort of an ersatz cost-benefit analysis. People are calling for it. They want us to do it. And then time frames and responsible agencies. You need to give everyone a time frame. How long is it going to take to do this before we expect to see some measurable results? You also need to say who is going to be responsible for monitoring this. That's another place where you need someone like a CAO or a city manager telling the General Services Agency or the Public Works Agency, yes, you will be in charge of this measure and you will monitor it. So our public hearing draft was just released. We have an EIR addendum. We managed to do an addendum to a general plan update we finished last year. That is going to be, so our plan will be a CEQA qualified plan. As I mentioned, the comments on the first draft went on and on. Luckily, most of those were about the smart meters, which we were able to dispense with one universal response. Budget. I threw this slide together yesterday, went through the contract, show you what we spent some of our money on. In order to get rid of that pass-through traffic and the traffic model, that cost us $30,000 of time with FAIR and peers. The local COG had a regional transportation plan that they did. FAIR and peers did a model for. FAIR and peers then adjusted it to get rid of the pass-through traffic, so we were able to use it. Public engagement, $36,000. This is only the consultant time. Having a town hall meeting is expensive. And the reason it's expensive is there's a tremendous amount of lead into it. There's media contacts. There's putting the thing together. It was a very big effort to have two of those. We also spent quite a bit of money on our LGC work, adaptation workshops, 2 years ago. We did a schools program. We partnered with AP, with our local air district to do a schools program in the fourth grade. We put in eight, APCD put in 10, and a private organization put in about 30,000. And we did a 2-year program in the fourth grade classes in all of the county schools. Matter of fact, we just got the after action report on that. We trained a number of teachers, something that we would like to keep going. And then our adaptation chapter, which I believe is going to be the first adaptation chapter in any climate action plan in the state, that's an estimate of about $5,500 just to put that that thing together. I think that's it. So once again, slowplanning.org. Take a look for the EnergyWise plan. I'd be happy to talk to any two people who want to talk about our EnergyWise plan. Best thing to do is email me, and I will be more than happy to bend your ear about anything you want to hear about. Thank you.
You did great on time, too, by the way.
I'll get it.
Oh, great. Thank you. All right, we are going to switch over and hear about Oakland's experiences under Garrett Fitzgerald and learn about what they've learned during this time. Garrett is handing out some of the documents that he's going to be talking about.
Thanks. Thank you very much. I would tell you what that says, but I'm still slightly under 40, and I actually can't read that. So when I'm passing around, I brought two copies of our draft Energy and Climate Action Plan. Don't undo the plastic buckle. So you have a copy, and you have a copy, and we just want to pass these around a little bit in case you want to see it. It's really long. I didn't want to give everybody a copy. I also brought, and I'll tell you about this, our brand new Sustainable Oakland 2010 report that I just finished last week, which I'm really excited about, almost as excited as getting married 3 weeks ago. And that's up here, and thank you very much. Along with a publication that we do, part of my job as the sustainability coordinator in Oakland is to write climate plans and those sorts of things, but it's also largely to help tell Oakland's sustainable city story. And so there's a lot of marketing stuff, just as we just heard about, that's clearly just crucial for these kinds of roles, which means that I've tried to learn as much graphic design. I can do things with Microsoft Word I didn't think were possible before starting this climate plan and this thing, which was done entirely in Microsoft Word by me. You can actually do some good stuff. And so there's some copies of those things, and I'll talk about a little bit more at the end. Where'd the clicker go? So I'm Garrett, I'm from Oakland, and this is Oakland. We're right across the bay from San Francisco. Lake Merritt in the middle that our downtown is next to is actually the first wildlife refuge in the country. It's actually also not a lake, it's an estuary, so it connects down with the San Francisco Bay. We're a city of about 400,000 people. We're known for a lot of different things, and you have probably heard one or two of them, but one thing that I'm trying to get us to be known as is one of the greenest cities in the country. Every national ranking that's come out where they've looked at like the 50 biggest cities in the US and tried to sort of rank them, we're always in the top 10 as far as green cities, which is really cool and also not known very well about Oakland. So we're doing a lot of great stuff. It turns out that in developing the Energy and Climate Action Plan, there's a lot of similarity between the story that I have to tell and the story that James just told about the process they went through, about how much money they spent on some of the things, about how they're dealing with CEQA. So I'm going to try to touch on some things that are a little bit different in this, but might skip over some details. So this is what I want to do. I want to walk through some of the questions that I think we ask ourselves as we're thinking about developing a climate plan. What we did in Oakland, we did as a standalone climate plan. So it's its own document, it's not part of the general plan. It's not part of any other policy document, but these same things basically apply regardless of how you're doing this. So the first one is why we're doing this. I'm not going to talk about this at all because I assume that we know in this room. What's the scope of the activity that we should actually be looking at? How do we pick a target? How do we go through the process involving the community? How do we kind of go through the process of developing this thing? And how do we structure it and present it so that it answers the questions that we want to answer? These very big questions about how do we stop this really big problem? While at the same time is also politically palatable, something we can advance, and something that will actually give us some clear direction for the near term. How do we start answering this giant problem, right? And we spent a lot of time thinking about those questions. How do we deal with environmental review, which is the one that I'm spending most of my time thinking about now, which has become a real pain in the butt? And how do we manage implementation and reporting as we go forward? So scope of activity, I think we almost always see a very similar pie chart with maybe little subdivisions within these things. But for the most part, whenever we tell this story about what the emissions are associated with our communities, it's transportation and it's buildings. And they're both really big, and in some places one's bigger than the other, and other places the other one's bigger, and a lot of that has to do with what did you count, how did you count it, and I don't really care about any of that. The story is that these are both really big. And the other story is that there's a whole other way of thinking about emissions associated with our communities. That's not that way, but look, slicing the data a different way, thinking about what's the impact of all the stuff that we buy. Not all the way up and down this life cycle chain, right? From blowing the top off the mountain so that we can mine the coal, so that we can send that someplace, so that we can make some widgets, so they can go to another place and we can make bigger widgets. And eventually we can buy that widget, and eventually we can throw that widget away. Well, if you take this view of what our emissions sort of carbon footprint is as community, then the big number is in this stuff. And then there's smaller numbers in moving ourselves around, moving goods around, moving the stuff around is all part of that big stuff number. We're moving ourselves around, heating the buildings, which we don't clearly do much of in this particular facility. That goes in other places. So the big story from these two different ways of looking at emissions is that all three of those things really matter. They can all be really big. And what we want to do in Oakland is to try to address all of those issues at once and uniformly. So what we try to gather numbers for all of those things. So this is how I tell the story of what our emissions are in Oakland. It's not one number. It's not 3 million tons or 4 million tons or whatever. You know, the entire climate plan, we never add these up into one number because some of these things should not be added together. They're different kinds of numbers altogether. And what we don't want to do is give ourselves an excuse to say, well, we'll work on this part of it and we'll leave that part of it alone, because in reality, hitting the 2050 goals that we're all talking about, let alone the 2020 goals, we have to do a lot in all of these different areas at once. So we try to break things out, and we had a lot of pressure in our community to look at things that are maybe a little bit hard for a local government to affect. So the operations of our port. The Port of Oakland doesn't report to the city. There's some sort of loose affiliation there, but we can't control the day-to-day operations of the port and what they do. Looking at air travel from Oakland associated with planes leaving Oakland. Looking at what that big red number I showed you earlier, upstream life cycle emissions of stuff bought by folks in Oakland. Now, this is not a real number. This is a wild-ass guess, as one of our earlier speakers said, but it's based on how many people we have in Oakland, how much wealth do they have, what kinds of things do we think they buy based on national data, and we can actually put that into a carbon calculator tool that some folks at Carnegie Mellon developed. And we can at least give ourselves a snapshot to see, wow, that upstream life cycle impact of stuff we buy is in fact huge. On an order of magnitude, this is you know, as big as all of the stuff we really pay attention to a lot put together. So probably if we could, we should try to think about this too. Of course, we're not set up very well to do that, and so we address that a little bit in the climate plan. But I would not argue we've tackled this problem. But we decided let's start to shine a light on all these different types of emissions that anybody in the community might say this is relevant. This is something we should be looking at. This is something someone should be doing something about. Out of that, we also said we need to scope our exercise. We're developing a climate plan which is answering the question: what can the city government do in Oakland to help Oakland on a community-wide basis achieve a certain emissions reduction target? What's our role as a city And so the reality is, out of all of these different things that somebody might say are worth quantifying and are worth thinking about, there's a subset of those, which I call our local government focus areas, that we think we have a higher degree of influence or control over as a city government. So when we wrote our climate plan, the plan is a plan to hit a target with respect to those things. So we're not hiding from the community. We're not giving anybody a chance to say, you guys aren't, you're pretending like the Port of Oakland doesn't exist. You know, we're not doing that. But we're also trying to be kind of clear up front about what we think we can affect and what we think we can't. And that has helped to manage the scope of the project all along the way. One other thing that's interesting about this, you know, so what we did here, we have transportation on local roads that we consider to be within our purview, and I put transportation on highways down here. The reality is that highway trips that either start or stop, or both, in Oakland, we probably can affect, maybe just as much as we can affect even the local road traffic. But an awful lot of that transportation on highways in Oakland is pass-through, as James was saying, and we have not in the Bay Area been able to separate out how much of that probably is passed through. It's not possible yet for us right now. The modeling doesn't let us do that. So what we said is we can measure the local road stuff, and as imperfect a process as that is. So we're gonna track that, and as we're doing reporting, we're gonna report on that number, the local roads impact number. And we're assuming that all the things we're doing that make this transportation on local roads number go down over time, they're probably also gonna have a similar effect on the highway trips that are affectable, that do start or stop within Oakland. And our goal right now is to actually throw all of this out. And by a year from now, we're hoping that we never show this number again, or if we do, it's more buried than it is here. And then instead, we will be able to tell a story about as we estimate the transportation impacts from any given city, that we use this origin destination model where we say if a trip starts and stops in Oakland, we count all of that, the distance of that trip. If it either starts or stops in Oakland, doesn't matter where the other end of it is, we'll take half of that. And if it neither starts nor stops here, if it's purely passing through us, then we take zero. And we're hoping, we're kind of pushing in the Bay Area to improve the modeling so that we can all go to that type of a process, because the story that you see about transportation is very different that way. If you're San Francisco, and you're not willing to build housing that people can buy, and everyone's living an hour and a half to the east of the hills, and they're actually driving through Oakland, and their numbers are counting for us, right? Then your transportation story at San Francisco probably changes dramatically if you have to take the hit of half of that trip distance from all those trips that start or stop in San Francisco, but not both. So there's going to be some really interesting ramifications to this. These are the kinds of things that will... some of us who really geek out on these numbers and the politics around this stuff really like to think about, and I'd love to talk with you about that. So what should the target be? I'm not gonna spend much time on this. What we did is we went back and we said, what do the world's climate scientists say the target needs to be? The best stuff that's out there is from the IPCC in the fourth assessment report that they put out, where they basically say industrial world needs to hit at least a 25% reduction from 1990 by 2020. We don't have 1990 data. The exercise of trying to figure out what our 1990 numbers are, to me, is a complete waste of time. There's no way to get good data going back that far. We can't even get good data back to a few years ago. So what we did is we tried to kind of estimate how much we think things changed from 1990 to 2005, because we do have a data set for 2005, and we use that as our baseline. So that's why the 36 is this kind of weird number. It's actually the translation of 25% below 1990, we think, is the same thing as 36 below 2005. But the big thing is that we always present this number in a percentage. We never total things up. We never say we're trying to reduce by a million tons by 10 years from now, because we want to apply this across all of those buckets of emissions, across land use transportation issues, across building issues, across waste issues. This is our no excuses approach. We don't think it's okay to say, oh, a power plant shut down, our building-related emissions went down, so I guess we don't have to work on transportation too much because we made more than the goal already in buildings because somebody closed up shop and left town. It's not really the point of climate planning, right? So we're trying to avoid that sort of thing happening and skewing our numbers and politically kind of messing with our goals here. So let's mostly talk about strategy. So how do you develop a climate plan in a way, and then present it in a way where it's taking on the full challenge, where it's effective in driving some near-term action, It's telling you what to do, what to start on now, where it's lasting in its influence, where it's not just a document that you guys developed 10 years ago and no one's actually ever seen it since. But, you know, hey, the consultant finished their job and we got the document and we accepted it, which of course happens frequently. And that it's politically palatable and it's possible to actually get this thing adopted. So a couple highlights from the process that we went through in developing our plan. First, we looked a lot at our existing policy documents. One of the things that I think is going to save us in the process of some of the CEQA work we're now doing is that we really have taken the time to find all the places in our general plan elements and other adopted policy documents where we have language that supports climate goals. Half of the content of the climate plan, it turns out, we've already written down in lots of other documents, and this document is sort of a standalone piece, is bringing all that stuff together, maybe adding some detail to it. But we already knew in general plan we wanted to do more density and round transit corridors, right? So we're kind of shining a light on a lot of that stuff. We convened an internal multi-agency staff team from the very beginning, had a lot of regular meetings. These guys made all of the decisions. I found it to not be effective to assume that a consulting firm can tell you what the content of the plan should be. For me, it didn't work. We did use consultants. We also used a couple different consultants. We used one to do a lot of research and data analysis for us. We spent about $80,000 on that. And we used a different one, about $40,000, similar, I think, to James's example, to help us with community engagement. The research and analysis we made use of, but that consultant almost finished their work while we were only halfway through the process of developing the plan. So all of the writing of the document, all of the thinking about, okay, here are all the options we have for things that could go into the plan for different ways of reducing emissions, all of the decisions about that, it was all done by a little staff team. And that was very useful for us because that got a lot of internal staff really involved in having that decision-making process, got them involved with this document. They actually bring it up now in meetings. They cite it when we have a new fundraising opportunity. People hold it up and they say, hey, we already talked about that. We already decided what we're gonna do on that. It's written right here. Council already even approved this thing. We're gonna use this. We don't have to go wander around and open this back up to additional scrutiny. So the staff team was huge. We had a very, very active community process in Oakland. We started this process. It turns out that there are many more dozens of community-based organizations in Oakland that care about climate change than I ever would have imagined was the case. We had a coalition. They actually formed themselves into a coalition called the Oakland Climate Action Coalition. It's convened by a group called the Ella Baker Center in Oakland, which is a fantastic organization that really focuses on Oakland, focuses on green jobs development, lots of other really good things, who said, you know, if Oakland ends up with a strong climate plan and strong policies that are going to create real new work in Oakland, this is one of the best ways we can advance our green jobs agenda in Oakland. So what we're going to do is we're going to get all the other social justice, environmental, labor, et cetera, groups that are based here, get them all into a big coalition, and we're going to run community process. We didn't agree with everything that we got from them, but I made use of probably 2/3 of the ideas that they gave us ended up going directly into the plan. Some very smart people working on some very complex topics. So we held a few rounds of public workshops ourselves, open to anybody to come. Got lots and lots of ideas that way. What do you think should be in here? Okay, here's what we heard. How would you prioritize among these things? Here's what we're now thinking. How would you react to these ideas being in the plan ultimately? So we kind of did this in stages. But these guys were able to go out and take the show on the road. I had the resources to hold a few meetings in downtown in City Hall. Those guys were able to go out and hold meetings in neighborhoods all over the city, which for us as a larger city was very important. And they held workshops in Spanish in the Spanish-speaking community. So we got a lot of input into the process by really giving some ownership of the process over to a community group, kind of partnering in that way. We still made all the decisions about what goes in the plan, but we tried to utilize this resource, and I think it really, really worked. One of the big lessons learned for us, when I started this process, and it's fun to see this California CAPA is coming out, because I actually started CAPA about 4.5 years ago when I was at ICLEI. I believed in creating a spreadsheet for every action that might go into the climate plan. And for each one of these spreadsheets, I would build a little calculator that would show, here's what we might do, here's the energy savings I might get, here's what that would cost, here's what the GHG benefit will be, the air pollutant benefits. I'll try to come up with some kind of cost effectiveness criteria. and then maybe wind up with a lot of criteria that we can use to rank all of the actions, and we'll score each of the actions by each of the criteria, and then the computer will basically tell us this is the optimal combination of things that one could do. And it turns out that's really good in theory, but slightly hard to put into practice. The biggest reason it's really hard to put into practice is that half of the stuff we came up with that we thought we could do, you can't put a number to. And this is especially true with the transportation and land use area, certainly true with a lot of the waste-related things and a few of the building-related things. Most of the building energy use numbers you could put a number to. But with transportation and land use, if I want to double the frequency that buses run in Oakland, I have no idea what that will do on its own. Or if I want to add more bus stops in Oakland, or if I want to increase the density a little bit in certain places, it's beyond the capability of the modeling that we have, certainly any modeling that we could afford in a process like this. The best that we found we could do in some of these cases was to say, let's look at Portland. Portland has these six things are different about Portland than they are in Oakland. They have this frequency of bus service. They have this level of density along transit corridors. They have this kind of bike parking, whatever. And somehow across, well, these six things being basically the difference between us and them, they have this change in vehicle ridership and bus ridership and bicycling in the city. So let's assume that if we kind of do that combination of stuff in aggregate, maybe we'll end up with that kind of performance also. And frankly, half of what we have in transportation and land use section of this plan, that's as far as we could ever go in the quantification. We really got stuck on this. We got really frustrated on this. We want to be able to put a hard number to every single thing that's in here. And we found that we couldn't. But then as I think James also found, we found that there was never a point to trying to do that. You don't really need to do that. Because in reality, the 90% of the people who care about the content of the plan just care about, do I think that it makes sense to do that? Which might mean, do I think that someone should do that to me? Or do I think that should be done to someone else? Or do I think that's something I would like to see happen in my community? They don't actually care what the number is for these things. They don't want to see that kind of ranking. They just think something's a good idea or it's a bad idea. If it's a good idea, put it in. If it's a bad idea, don't put it in. And all of the conversation that we had with the community, all the feedback that we got was really about whether or not people thought things were good ideas or bad ideas. It wasn't about refine a model to quantify things better so that you can really defend this. What we ultimately did for our numbers was we put this stuff into an appendix to the document. So in the appendix, we tell a story of how we quantified everything. And it looks a little bit like this. And what we tried to do, we like similar to James, what we did is we started off with a baseline, 2005 baseline, a baseline forecast to 2020. And we said, here's where we think we'll be in 2020. And so for transportation and land use, we actually did that looking at for what we think the VMT number will be, what we think the gallons of fuel use will be, where we think miles per gallon will be, what we think the fuel coefficient CO2 per gallon of gasoline is. And then, as we all know, when you calculate all those things together, that's when you get your GHG number, right? So what we try to do is in the quantification is actually break all of those into little pieces. And then we said, okay, so here's this big state policy. Here's the Pavley stuff. Pavley stuff is going to have this impact on, I think it's miles per gallon, right? So we show in colors, this is the number that the big state policy will affect. As that gets played out, then that's going to affect these other numbers, and here's where we will then be in our GHG number for Oakland. And now, post-Pavley, here's the next big state policy, and we'll start with where we were there, and then we'll go to the next step, so that we can actually tell quantitatively the story of how much are we counting on the state to do for us. And this is important because when the local community later on holds us accountable to hitting our target, we need to be able to say, well, did the state do its part? Because the state, it turns out, in some areas is gonna get us about a third of the way there, and other areas is gonna get us as much as half of the way there, theoretically, by what the state has said that it's going to do. So it's really important that we know what that number is, both so that we know what our target needs to be for the additional action that we'll take locally, but also so that we can all kind of hold ourselves accountable at the end of the day. Did anybody do what they said that they were going to do? So that process is laid out in the appendix. It turns out that out of every 1,000 people, there are 4 that want to see the numbers. Sometimes those 4 are your agency director and one of your council members, and you absolutely have to have those numbers. It's not an option just because there's only 4 to not create them. But the other 996 folks really don't care. So we put very little in terms of the numbers in the plan itself. We stuck all that stuff in appendix, and anybody who wants it can go get it. And it seems like everybody's been satisfied by the degree of information that we've put out. So what should we be working on in the near term? One of our big goals here, so the 36% is a very aggressive greenhouse gas target. It's one of the biggest numbers that I've seen. And so we essentially anything we could think of that would help went in the plan. Unless it was clearly a really dumb idea, it's in there. And then for some things, we just had to adjust at the end, how big do we go with this? So what kind of energy reduction per home, per commercial building do we need to get to hit the plan? But the idea that we're gonna try to do some programs to get energy reductions in homes, of course, goes in the plan, right? So we decided that we need to make this actionable in some way. So it isn't just a giant laundry list of things we wanna do in the next 11 years, but instead we know how to hit the ground running, and not only that we have some direction, but also so that we can say the next time the next shiny ball bounces by in front of our elected officials, you know, we did think about that. We thought about actually all these different things, as you know, because you voted on this plan. That one got slotted into this level of priority. These other things got slotted in as stuff we should work on right away. So that's what we're working on. And yes, we do plan to get back to this thing that you're asking me about right now. And here's where that slotted in the priority list. So after 3 years, we plan to work on that. You approve that. And then they're like, oh, okay. So I'll ask you instead about the things you're supposed to be working on. Sometimes it's helpful. One of the big questions for us is how effective will that be in the long run at using the prioritization within the plan at deflecting attention on the new shiny balls as they bounce by? We'll all see. But this is how we did it. We decided to come up with a 3-year priority list out of the 11-year list. And for the 3-year priority list, we developed some criteria. We had the community vote on the criteria that we use for ranking things so that we could decide what should be in the first 3 years priority and what should be just later. We ultimately found that as good an idea as it was to come up with ranking criteria and try to prioritize these things, that just does it seem like it's doable in the next 3 years was the only criterion that matters, right? Which is based on how expensive is it gonna be? Does anybody have money for this already? Does it seem like we could actually politically do this right now? Ultimately, if it was doable in the next 3 years, it went in that list, and if it wasn't, it went in the other list. And a lot of those things we found actually do have funding already, and a lot of other things maybe don't. So what we tried to do is within the plan, the way we structured the plan, we have our big to-do list for the next 11 years. There's about 150 actions in that to-do list. We put, in addition to that, a separate, here's what we want to do in the first 3 years. And then we put that in front. And then out of that 3-year list, we split that in half and we said, here's the part of that that's funded already. And then here's the part that isn't, that we'll essentially either need you, council, to give us money for, or this is my fundraising plan for the next 3 years. So that anybody who wants to sort of ask us, are we doing what we said we would do in implementing the plan? I say there's a list of the 3-year funded stuff in the front of the plan. Go look at that, and I should be able at any moment to give you a status report on every one of those things. Because I told you, these are the things that we do in fact have resources for. And you approve this list. Everything else, no, it's probably not happened. We're probably fundraising for it. And in cases where we can make it happen, we're doing that. So I've showed in here that just kind of how we've structured that. So for each of these things that we've called out as priority, we write more about those things than we write about all the other actions in the long-term list. We usually put in a few paragraphs of a description of it. We say who's responsible for it. We say what the current status is. So is it already done or is it being done now? Who's doing it? For things that are not yet funded, we change that up a little bit, and we also put in the resource needs. So that as the council was approving the plan, they could see that here's everything we're doing that's already funded. For everything else that we want to do right away, it's 21 new FTEs, and it's $9 million a year. We added all that stuff up. So yes, we're happy to do that, but this is what, if you wanted us to just do those things that we've all agreed are the priority things, this is what would need to be allocated for that purpose, or we would need to find this to be able to move forward. And that helps kind of focus and manage that conversation. One or two more things for me. One is CEQA. So we've gone through this whole process and are now in the CEQA. It's actually, you'll see on the plan that we have here, it's still in draft form. And it's still in draft form because the one step we have to take to formally adopt it is do our environmental review process. We've actually gone through the council process. Council's given us all the direction that we're gonna get on changes to the plan itself. And we're trying to now wrestle with, so what does this mean to do CEQA on a climate plan? Which 5 years ago, when I was still at Ickley, we weren't even talking about this. Nobody was, we weren't, this, you know, climate plans are different. They're not plans. That CEQA thing doesn't apply here. Well, now it clearly seems to apply, and especially in the view of the folks from the state that we've met with who will hold us accountable on these things. So we're trying to figure it out. We really don't want to set a precedent that you should do an EIR on a climate plan. Partly because that's three times the budget that we've spent on the climate plan itself, and now the rest of the state's not going to do these at all. We'll just say we can't do that. Ideal scenario clearly would have been to find a way to roll this into the general plan if we were updating the general plan element at the same time, so that the budget there that's going to pay for the EIR for that general plan update is also going to be able to include this. That would have been really convenient. We're not doing that right now. We don't have that ability. The path that we're exploring is similar to the path that James took, where I think my goal here, we'll see if this works out, but the goal is to be able to, is looking at the content of the climate plan. If we can say that everywhere within the plan where there seems to be an impact under CEQA, this content that would be causing that impact potentially has actually already been included in the general plan, in one of our existing general plan elements. There's nothing new here from a CEQA perspective. Then if we can say that, then we could do a negative declaration, or we could do an addendum to the EIR that we have for our general plan, which is preferable between the two because it's harder to challenge, and potentially be done. If we can't do that, we're stuck with a decision about, would it be better to change wherever the one or two or five pieces of content are in the plan so that they no longer trigger something under CEQA? Can we just kind of dumb the plan down a little bit from that perspective and avoid now having to go through a more significant process? Or we go out with a negative declaration on our own and hope it doesn't get challenged, or we decide to pony up and do a full EIR. Personally, I look at the content, was most of these climate plans that we're developing are really big to-do lists for us as city governments. In very few cases do we end up putting the kind of detail into the climate plan that tells you exactly how you're going to do X or Y. There's a statement that says, let's try to do more density near downtown transit-oriented corridors, right? I'm not saying anything about what the density level is going to be or exactly which parts of the city on a map I'm affecting. It's probably not really possible for me to provide any additional detail at this stage that one would actually then subject under an environmental review process. So if all I'm really doing is writing myself a mental note, next time we update our zoning, let's make sure we're thinking about density. Is there some other way I can word that, where now the CEQA, what I now need to do under CEQA at this stage changes? Maybe, and that's the conversation that we're in the middle of with our city attorney and the exploration that we're doing with some consultants now. So lastly, on implementation and reporting, we've set up an internal sustainability advisory team, kind of building from the momentum of developing the climate plan. We have folks in all these different agencies at this point, so we've now grouped everybody into a team that's keeping us on track and making sure everybody's doing what they're supposed to be doing, and we've gotten that kind of mayor and city administrator level buy-in for this team. This is another thing that I coordinate. And as new ideas come out about things that we ought to be doing as a city that we're not doing right now, that probably aren't getting done because it takes some level of interdepartmental collaboration to make them happen, this team is also able to start those new things as well. And we're launching new programs. So because we went through this process of developing the plan, for example, we figured out just how much energy savings do we want to get from our commercial sector to be able to meet this big picture goal. And we've been able to now articulate that. And we went after some grants. We actually got, under the last round of the at state level funding through the state energy program, we got a $5 million grant to do a downtown Oakland commercial energy efficiency program. Partly because we got pretty smart on this stuff because we did that thinking as part of the climate plan development. So we were able to get $5 million. We're going door to door and doing energy retrofits in all of the buildings within a 200 block area of downtown. We've knocked on every door, and Martin Bond, who's here somewhere, his firm is running that for us. and trying to get to a 20% energy reduction in 80% of the businesses that occupy this 200 block area of downtown. So we're in the middle of this right now, and we're already finding we have to adjust as we go based on how easy it is to get folks to participate. But because we've done a lot of the number crunching in developing the climate plan, we kind of know what our initial plan was, and we've been able to be a little bit more adept in the adjustment. And lastly, on the reporting side, I tell the city's sustainability story by breaking sustainable, what a sustainable city means. What is that? What are these things that are part of being a sustainable city into these six buckets? And you can look at this later. But what we do is we take those six buckets and we put them into a report, where for each one of the buckets, we try to tell little stories about what are the recent achievements, the cool stuff that's happening, and more we're trying to graph everything. So we're right now in the stage of trying to identify what are those key performance metrics that we should be using to tell the story of is all this working? Are we getting there? So that we can say, yeah, we have that policy, but we can also say, and it's working. And a lot of this is captured in this 2010 report that we just put out. So if you're interested in how we're doing some of our reporting, you can take a look at that. So those are, I think those are the big stories. Tell the big picture story, but make it actionable. Identify some near-term priorities. Really putting the time into that community engagement really has bought us a lot of additional political support. And that group that helped, that came together around advising what should go into our climate plan, now that the climate plan is done, has just gone through their own new 3-month strategic visioning process and decided we're going to stay together. We're now going to pick out 4 things from the climate plan that are in that near-term category, and we're going to work on making these happen ourselves, because we know the city's doing some of the other ones. We're going to work on a few of these themselves. They've just launched a community solar purchasing program and some other things. So we've by working with them and really getting them excited in the process of developing the plan, we now have this ongoing body to work with connections throughout the community that's also making Energy Upgrade California outreach go better, et cetera. Not getting stuck in the data analysis, assigning responsibility, making it readable. So you'll see I spent a lot of time on formatting in here because I want to make sure that someone will actually look at the document at the end. And then committing to a living document. James touched on this. The biggest thing that we've done is we've committed to updating this climate plan every 3 years, because we know what the science around what the target needs to be is going to change. The way we tell the baseline story is going to change. We're going to get some of those actions done that we said we're going to, and we're probably not going to get others done. So let's make sure that we keep refreshing that story. We keep it politically completely active as we go. So that's it for me. Thank you very much.
Okay, we are at the end here. We have about 5 minutes for questions, and I'd like to open it up and see who among you have questions. Our speakers were really motivational and put a really nice practical spin on how to get this done. I heard a lot of things from both of them that were really, they answer a lot of the questions that I get all the time. A lot of it is perspective and framing. So thank you. Excellent job. And who's got some questions for our speakers?
Thank you. I'm with a small city in the Bay, East Palo Alto, and we're looking at the climate action plan that we had consultants prepare. One of the areas that I saw, that there were two areas that were really interesting. One had to do with the adaptation component in the plan, the change of not using numbers, quite unique. And my question goes to really the heart of CEQA, because that is one of the areas that we are looking at. And insofar as a plan that is adopted by a local government addresses the climate action plan that's adopted by the local government addresses the critical findings and policies adopted by a community that have already been weighed in the general plan, then I've seen a couple of different approaches, the negative deck and the mitigated negative deck. And the mitigated negative deck, as an example, would be City of Albany. I believe that's what they've chosen. They have not such a radical, or I shouldn't say radical, but aggressive 36% reduction strategy they have a greater reduction strategy than many other communities. And I see that on the low end, 15% is what we as a community have adopted. So to get to the chase, I know there are probably a bunch of other questions, is what other factors, when you're looking at the analysis in accordance with the CEQA, outside of the general plan, you have targeted, I mean, many of the plans are changing because of the housing element, and that addresses the population component. Are there other issues that you've identified that are critical decision makers in addition to the general plan?
I'd speak for us. What we've we put a list of them in the appendix to our document. We actually, I think, called out between 8 and 10 different existing city policy documents, which include several elements of the general plan, but there's a couple of other policy documents in there as well, where we pull out individual statements, principles or policy statements, whatever they might be, from those documents that all support and reinforce and are the same essentially as what's in here. So you can get a specific list of what those are from the appendix to our plan.
If I might, and your plan, does it include an adaptation strategy as well that is also being analyzed? That being such a new area, BCDC is just now sort of adopting the new Bay Plan Amendment, which will affect all communities around the Bay. Mm-hmm. So that is a component of it.
Yeah, we have a chapter on adaptation in there as well that I didn't take time to go into. But I think similar to a lot of the climate plans we're seeing now, our plan is 90% mitigation, 10% adaptation probably in terms of content. But a lot of our most interesting work right now is now on the adaptation front. There's a lot of cool stuff happening in the Bay Area that BCDC is running, where we're starting to look at a much greater level of detail at our vulnerabilities to sea level rise and storm events. And so there's a much more in-depth analysis of that that's happening right now on Southern Alameda County, where I think we're going to all learn a lot from as well. So we actually spend, as staff time, we're spending probably as much time on adaptation right now as we are on some of the mitigation items.
Yeah, a good point. We don't believe that the adaptation chapter is going to be a CEQA significant in the CEQA sense. We do believe, however, that our local hazard mitigation plan, that will be that plan that implements all of that, might be subject to CEQA. Our environmental emergency services division, which is actually going to be doing that local hazard mitigation plan, does not agree. And so, timely question. I'm not sure what the answer is. What does happen to adaptation vis-a-vis CEQA? We're fighting that. We're discussing that now in our jurisdiction, and I don't have the final answer, so I can't tell you. I tend to think that if the local hazard mitigation plan is pointing to things that you have to do differently than you're doing now, or policy differences in your general plan, you've got to do a CEQA document. At least it seemed kind of simple to me.
Well, I want to thank our speakers very much, and Garrett and James will be available as well for questions later on, I imagine. We need to clear out because our next speaker is ready to come on up right in here. So thank you very much.